Welcome to another edition of Blue Republican Radio with me, Robin Kerner, the original Blue Republican. Here we are again for the Liberty Curious. And a couple of weeks ago, my regular listeners will know, I had a good friend on my show, a friendship that was actually birthed out of one of my older projects, about a decade old now, WatchingAmerica.com, when I lived in New York, which is the home of my guest. His name is Barry Farber, and if you check the Blue Republican Radio archives now, you will be able to find the first interview I did with Barry on this show a couple of weeks ago. And it was, as always, talking to Barry is a wonderful experience. It is not an accident that he was voted the ninth greatest talk show host in the United States, I remember. I'm sure nine was way too big a number, Barry. But it was a pleasure for me, since my interview with you, to be on your show, being interviewed by you. Thanks for that opportunity, Barry. And
it was a delight.
Yeah, that's a mutual feeling entirely. But after, I don't know if it was on that show, let me back up. You pressed me on that show quite reasonably about what a Ron or Rand Paul presidency might mean for foreign policy. And you actually asked me a very specific question, which is a good question, about what would have happened in the Second World War, with respect to America's support of Britain against the Nazis. And knowing, of course, that I, as a Brit, I'm actually quite happy that the Americans' support became one of the Allies in the Second World War, when the country of my birth was indeed in huge trouble. And I'm going to say at this point, there was a wonderful quote, a quote of Stalin, believe it or not, that summed up so much of the Allied side in one sentence. He said that the Americans gave the money, the British gave the time, and the Russians gave the blood. And of course, the British giving the time referred to this time of the period of standing alone, holding off the Nazis under the Battle of Britain when the British stood alone against Germany. But we really explored this. We really explored what a non-interventionist leaning foreign policy would mean for American security, and indeed the security of the Anglosphere. And I can't remember if it was at the end of that interview on air or just after. I think it might have been just after. You said something to me, Barry, that was fascinating, and I would just like you to unpack in the hour that we have together here. You said, quote, "I'm one of the few neocons who supported going into Iraq and will admit to having made a mistake." Now, I've got a few questions. What do you mean when you identify as a neocon? What does that word mean to you? And to talk about why you supported it and why now you feel that a mistake was made in that second war in Iraq.
All right, what you just said conjures up other things that begs, that scream for attention, but we'll have enough time to deal with everything, so I'll answer what you ask now first. Mm-hmm. You say, what do I mean by a neocon? To me, that just means those who jet off of the old wagon onto the new wagon. There is a chance for freedom to break out and conquer the world. Freedom can be an international imperative, like running water. Freedom, we thought, had broken out in the Soviet Union, in Eastern Europe, and we figured, why not? Why not? Who in the world? What have you ever heard anybody say, I prefer to live under a dictatorship? I have not. I've heard some people praise authoritarian and even totalitarian regimes for their stability, their ability to organize. No, there is no amount of totalitarian organization that can equal the energy, the spontaneity, the imaginity of what you represent, free enterprise.
Yes.
You are free to make of yourself You are limited by your capabilities, not by any government agency.
Yes.
You know, to get a clean picture of this, a friend of mine was complaining about India. One reason India is surging is they have gotten rid of what I'm going to tell you now, which is only about 20 years old. Dear friend of mine, an eclectic American multimillionaire, did a lot of business in India. The two short stories he told, there was an Indian worker, plain old worker, but he wanted to manufacture shirts and sell them and then build a small factory and then a larger factory. The bureaucrats, in refusing him a license, bawled him out. And said, what do you know about making shirts? And in effect, just get back down there, sit down, and shut up. There was a bicycle firm that was doing very well, and they wanted to do even better than very well and expand. So they had to go to the Indian government bureaucracy. You know what the bureaucrat said in anger? Look, you are already number one in your industry in India. Let the others try to catch up with you. Your application is denied. When that mentality was scrubbed out, dropped into Death Valley in sulfuric acid, that was a very good thing for India. Look at India now. Look at Indonesia now. So anyhow, I have no shame in thinking the Iraqi people wanted to be rid of a hated dictator. I've done it enough time in dictatorships. I know the people of Yugoslavia when I was there for 6 weeks in 1951. I know they wanted to get rid of Tito. We saw what happened when freedom broke out in Eastern Europe. What happened to communism in Poland? Did Latvia, Lithuania, and Estonia wanted to stay free and loving junior partners of the Soviet Union? Of course not. So I have no shame of having thought it would be a cakewalk and we would be doing a great job to enable the Iraqi people to be free.
So let me understand why that makes sense. But why Iraq? Because the same argument could have been made for, can be made for many other dictatorships. The reason we went into Iraq rather than other totalitarian regimes was allegedly at the time because of the weapons of mass destruction, which we know they didn't have now. So the weapons of mass destruction reason was not a reason for you, just your active kind of foot forward on international freedom was good enough?
You know, sometimes you can get the truth only when the debate is over. Robin, you're a young man. Stay healthy, and I think you're going to live to see a historical reversal of what you just said. The smart money today, in my mind, said there were weapons of mass destruction. They were given to Syria, they were given to Iran, or they were buried in the desert. We went there and we couldn't find them. It's quite a leap to say we couldn't find them. I mean, Iraq is not Monaco. Iraq is not one of these micro republics between Spain and France, like Andorra. It's a pretty big country.
Yes.
So to say we didn't find them, that's a nice sentence. That's a nice thought. Thoroughly accurate. But to say we didn't find them and therefore they weren't there is a little bit of a jump. So I just want to go on the record saying that.
Okay, fair enough. So does the claim that they did have weapons of mass destruction at the time, was that part of why you were confident about? Go ahead.
No, I have a strange reason for justifying our move into Iraq. America invaded and occupied a country in 1941. Everything was better because America did that. The people of that country were a little, their feelings were hurt, but there was, you know, we were humane. It was an American-style occupation, so there were no atrocities. there wasn't a shot fired. We took over a country and really helped civilization move forward. Now, I have yet to meet an American who can tell me what it was. They'll say 1941. Well, that's when the Japan bombed Pearl Harbor.
Okay, you know what, Barry? We're going into the break, so you can tell us when we come back.
Okay.
We are talking to Barry Farber, and when we went into this last break, he was telling us about the American occupation of a foreign country that happened in 1941 that no American knows about. Barry, over to you. Please carry on.
All right. In 1941, England was an elephant dangling over a cliff with its tail tied to a daisy. France had fallen. The late Adolf Hitler and the late Joseph Stalin were allies in March 1941. America was neutral, and England stood alone. Winston Churchill called Roosevelt and said, "We need every British soldier we can get here in the homeland. Would you mind occupying Iceland so we can withdraw our garrison back to England, and the Germans will have no opportunity to invade and seize Iceland." You saw how much damage the German submarines did when they had to use their European ports. What if they had had Iceland as a base, almost halfway between England and America?
Mm-hmm.
The Battle of the Atlantic would have been much worse. Well, Roosevelt said to Churchill, "Sure, what are friends for? We, in effect, invaded Iceland. We moved in. We took them over. They didn't like it. They didn't hate it. They were better off. It helped their economy. Iceland is a member of NATO. Everybody fought better ever after, that the Germans had no chance to seize Iceland. This is chapter one. It's not going to take many more sessions. Don't worry about it.
But, this is fascinating, Barry, as always.
All occupations are not brutal. Some occupations are merciful. It was very good for civilization that Hitler was denied the use of Iceland as a base in World War II.
Mm.
Now, terrorists, Al-Qaeda, was the celebrity terrorist organization at the time. They knew 9/11's running furtively from cave to cave.
Barry, you broke up there. You broke up the last couple of sentences. Could you say the last couple of sentences again? Because I can hardly hear you.
Okay. Terrorist organizations need countries. This is very important now with ISIS in Iraq and Syria.
Mm-hmm.
Terrorists need bases. They can't do 9/11s. They can't plot and plan 9/11s running from cave to cave with cell phones. They need embassies. They need treasuries. They need chancellories. They need laboratories. If the terrorists want a training camp, they need an authority that can move 5,000 people out of a valley so the terrorists can work there. Terrorists need countries. We kicked them out of Afghanistan. Now, what was the most likely country to give itself over to al-Qaeda? I suggest it was Saddam Hussein's Iraq, because we had chased him out of Kuwait, laid waste to his army, and when he saw what al-Qaeda was capable of doing, we think he would have donated Iraq, dedicated Iraq to being a terrorist base. So with the horror of 9/11, it changed things. You can actually talk about what's changed since the last time we talked, by the way. But the world has changed, Robin. It's a different background now than when you and I talked a very few days ago. So here we wanted to preserve. We moved into Iraq to do, just like we moved into Iceland to keep the Nazis from getting it. We moved into Iraq to keep al-Qaeda from getting Iraq as a base by virtue of Saddam Hussein's donation.
And yet we know that a lot of them have camped out in other places that are very hard for us to, let's say, occupy, such as, those remote mountains and the borders of Pakistan, et cetera, et cetera. How far does that logic go? Because if we take Iraq, then don't we just invite them to settle elsewhere?
Well, but there were what other elsewhere? Was there a big country, a real country, again, with treasuries, with embassies, with all the perks and attributes of a real country? What other country had just lost a terrible war to America, been chased out of what it felt was a glorious conquest, which mm-hmm. Saddam Hussein felt about too late? Mm-hmm. Saddam Hussein's Iraq was the logical country to say to al-Qaeda, come on in, come on in, we should work together.
So another question becomes, so really that rests on the idea that we have to fight them over here so that, you know, fight them over there so they don't hurt us over here, as was said at the time. There is a calculus here. There's a moral calculus here, because our intervention in Iraq, let's say to make it unavailable to the kind of terrorists you're talking about, obviously involved the death of hundreds of thousands of civilians, and the numbers are disputed, but, you know, we're talking many, many people. And then, of course, there is the risk. There's always the risk associated with the chaos you cause and the unknown, which you could say is kind of what we're now suffering from. So when you make that moral calculus, you have to be quite convinced, do you not, that without fighting them over here, over there in Iraq, we could not protect ourselves from whatever they might be planning if they had settled in Iraq and were sponsored by Saddam's regime? Could we not defend ourselves without such action?
Well, Robin, first of all, as far as the moral calculus is concerned, that's why I said I felt I was wrong. I didn't know there were going to be hundreds of thousands of lives lost. I thought the people of Iraq would come into the streets like the people of Denmark did, right, when the Hitler was destroyed, like the people of the Baltic states did when communism appeared to collapse in the Soviet Union. I thought it was going to be a joyous celebration of freedom, a joyous liberation. And I was wrong. It didn't work out that way. I'm awfully, awfully sorry about that. I wish it had. I think it should have, but it did not. So as far as fighting them over there versus over here, I see no moral calculus there. Can you imagine in World War II, Eisenhower?
No, of course.
Can you imagine them saying, no, we're not convinced Germany can reach America. We're going to fight them over here. We're not going to go fight them over
No, here. I didn't mean, I wasn't suggesting for a minute that we should fight them here if they were here. The thing is, what I meant was, could we not keep them from reaching us, given the means that they would have available, even if they were sponsored by a regime like Saddam's? What I'm saying is, could we not make sure they didn't get here, even if we weren't inflicting that on them over here, over there?
Well, With a southern border like we have, I wouldn't make any bets on who could not get here.
Well, indeed.
I don't think there's anybody who couldn't get here if they wanted to. They should all get here.
But that would have been, would it not, an appropriate response to this fear, would have been to secure the border. And that would have been a very good alternative.
Well, in hindsight, absolutely. But we haven't done it yet. And we have a president now who doesn't want to. I can't understand why, but I can't understand why this president has done virtually anything he's done, including play golf 5 minutes after leading the nation in recoiling from the beheading of American journalist James Foley. I don't understand this president. I will do what I can to precipitate the downfall of his agenda, and I just hope we get a Republican in next time. Blue or any other color.
Barry, we're going into the break. Point well made. Thank you. Welcome back to Blue Republican Radio. What an interesting chat, as always, with Barry Farber. So let me ask you then, Barry, why do you feel now, with some hindsight, we were not successful in Iraq in the sense of being greeted and being welcomed, and therefore that we were set up in some ways for foreign policy failure rather than success?
Robin, I do like to do in Israel and start at the end. Everybody loved Fidel Castro for his first 10 days in power in 1959. But when we saw how busy the Cuban firing squads were, I was sent to Cuba to try to get word to Castro that he was destroying his good name. And he was destroying the admiration the American people had for him, and he was ruining everything for those of us who wanted a free, democratic Cuba. We were all pro-Castro. The radio show I worked for at the time raised money. I guess we were gun runners for Castro. So I was sent to try to reach a member of the Cuban cabinet. Well, as luck would have it, one walked right into my lap. I was in the makeshift presidential palace when Raul Castro came in from the jungle with the Vilma Estime, the woman he was going to marry. And so we were all very welcome guests because we were periodistas norteamericanos, American journalists. And I made my pitch. Mm-hmm. I said, we raised money for you. We really did everything we could in America to help you win. And now your firing squad was terrible, Robin. Castro killed more people in his first half hour than Adolf Hitler killed in his first 6 years. The firing squads were unbelievable. And here was my approach. I said, Raul, there was another country about the size of Cuba, similar number of people. They were occupied by a terrible dictator for about the same period of time as you Cubans suffered under Batista. And when it was all over, guess what? They had long, boring trials, and they wound up executing Vincent Quisling, the leader of the betrayal, to Germany, and two of his associates, and that was that. And look at all the people you're killing now. Well, he looked at me as though he wanted me to be the next one killed. He said, all you've done is prove that Cubans are bad Norwegians. And he turned around and stormed away. Wow. Well, I guess I've learned that Iraqis are bad Danes. They're bad Frenchmen. They're bad Belgians. They're even bad Italians. Italy was an enemy country, but they were overjoyed. They welcomed their troops. American GIs of Italian descent invading Sicily in 1943 had dinner that night in the beachfront villas of their cousins in Italy. That's what I was expecting. To this day, I can't imagine why the Iraqi population turned us down. But, you know, when you realize people kill each other, people of the same religion kill each other because of a difference, a theological difference of something that happened in the 7th century, then maybe we should be ready for Iraqis not acting like Danes.
So you're laying some of this, at the feet of cultural difference, deep cultural difference.
Absolutely. Look, I'm sorry. I will never forgive the Iraqi people. Look what a chance they had. Why didn't they rise up and choose freedom? They had it. They had the chance. They could see what happens when Arabs live in freedom. Look at the Arabs who live in freedom in Israel. Look at the Arabs who used to live in the only Arab democracy, Lebanon. Hmm. They were not just free, they were prosperous. Life was wonderful there. And this totalitarian extremism of any kind, happens to be Islamic extremism here, ruin it for everybody. It becomes a totalitarian trash heap.
So how would what happened in Iraq, if it would at all, affect your position on a future intervention? Does it make you more wary of, let's call it, neocon interventionism or, you know, intervention? Yes. How does that, what's the lesson to be learned going forward here?
Well, it's mainly a question of attitude. If I wanted to see a free Syria, believe me, my internal intellectual wet blankets would put out that fire fairly quickly, having seen what we've seen in Iraq. The first thing they taught us in the Boy Scouts was never help old ladies across the street if they don't want to go.
Yes.
Because it leads to violence every time. No. I want to erase the Syrian-Iraqi border as we go after ISIS. But I don't do it with any hope of bringing democracy to Syria. I bring it only with hope of bringing utter desolation to ISIS.
Okay. But now, okay, so we're shifting ground here a little bit because I can see a separate argument for, as you say, bringing desolation to ISIS. But that's, I'm still interested in the implementation of, if you like, your kind of philosophical view of foreign intervention for freedom. Is that something now, given what we've learned in, or what we saw happened in Iraq, is this something you would be less inclined to support in the Muslim world, but equally inclined to support elsewhere? Or okay, go ahead, Barry.
No, I was just going to say, every other example that inspired me to fight for freedom, to make policy friendly to freedom, to invade for freedom, make freedom possible, every other example was not in the Islamic world.
Yes.
It was in Eastern Europe, Western Europe, and I got to include Latin America because they really thought they were getting freedom. They didn't think they were getting Castro.
Yes.
Except for the fact that they were speaking different languages, you can't imagine how similar the laments were of Yugoslavs who fought for Tito and Cubans who fought for Castro.
And I should just say for my listeners, Barry, that you were in both places. You're speaking now from some extensive personal experience.
Well, no bullets were flying around me. This was after everything was quiet. Yes, I was in both places. But you should never convince me that they were two different people speaking. They didn't look alike. They didn't speak the same language, but they were saying the same thing. Those who fought for Tito and those who fought for Castro saying, we weren't fighting for this. We weren't fighting for communism. We were fighting for freedom. And Tito was smart enough to pretend we're going to be like America. In his speeches before partisan groups in the mountains, in the valleys, we're going to fight and we're going to be in America. Because every Yugoslav has one thing. There's not a Yugoslav in the world who doesn't have a cousin in McKeesport, Pennsylvania. They know all about America, and they wanted to emulate America. And Cuba, it was worse because they not only knew America because of cousins, they knew America because they'd been there. And the traffic was two ways. A lot more Cubans visited America as tourists than Americans did visiting Cuba as tourists. Yeah. They know what we have here. So you're right. The Islamic world has not yet proven it wants freedom. As a matter of fact, you could say they've almost proven they don't.
Yeah, this is very interesting. And this is a question. I don't know the answer to this question, but I think you might. Is it more accurate to say, looking at modern history, certainly your lifetime, that successful, let's call them interventions made by America in foreign lands to the benefit of freedom, that they have been more American-supporting movements for freedom that have come up from the people themselves, rather than the kind of outside-in intervention that we really did more in Iraq, where you don't have a significant body of people identifiable as a freedom movement that is active, and then we kind of, almost at their invitation, go and support them. Does history show that one works better than the other?
Yeah, Robin, that's a very sophisticated, very educated and helpful question. I would say yes, there were groups of people who knew America, wanted their constitution modeled after America, and things seemed to work, but not everything all the time. You know, America used to own the Philippine Islands.
Yeah.
We never had an empire like yours, but we had a pretty good one. We gave the Philippine Islands away. We gave them their freedom after World War II. And unfortunately, they didn't become a Jeffersonian democracy. You could not ever have confused the Philippine Islands with being America's 51st, 52nd, or 53rd state. It was Americans, liberated slaves, who built the nation of Liberia in West Africa.
Yeah.
Liberia has not distinguished itself in any way that would make an American proud. So we've got an interesting little scrapbook, but it's not as fat as we'd like it to be with success.
And what about failures? I mean, because there is another side to it, right? I guess Vietnam is obviously almost too obvious to mention. Was that, you know, again, the moral calculus, in hindsight, should that have been done? But we've also intervened in other countries like certainly Guatemala and so on and so forth. Egypt, I'm going back to the 50s now. You know, there's also an important part of this, that your action to support freedom becomes more moral to the extent that you succeed in your intended goals. And there's also the huge unknown of such interventions, right? When you, as I say, go from the outside in without a lot of internal support, I think often there are these unintended consequences that can reverberate through decades or ages. Something else we need to be sensitive to.
Well, I don't know if I'm addressing your point. If so, redirect me. But the overlay, the American isotopes that we managed to inject into countries where we have intervened. And I do want to question your somebody listening casually would assume that Americans just, you know, beavers build dams, spiders weave webs, and Americans intervene. Don't forget, all we asked from the countries we invaded in World War II was enough land to bury our dead.
Yes.
You got the wrong act. Don't mistake the Allies. It was the Russians who kept the territory under their political control.
Oh, I'm not drawing any moral equivalence.
Not the Americans and not the Brits.
Absolutely. No. I think the Second World War is of a different thing from the kind of thing, for example, that the Dulles brothers were up to in the 50s, you know, picking the regime that they thought they could nudge towards freedom, intervening often mostly covertly, sometimes overtly. The idea that, you know, they can change the histories of countries or even regions without the consent or invitation of significant amounts of people there. So I don't think this is the same as the Second World War. I don't draw any moral equivalence between the Anglosphere in the Second World War and its aftermath and the Soviet Union, for example. That would be absurd. I'm just talking about, you know, when we intervene in this way, in the non-Second World War way, we're dealing necessarily in massive uncertainties. And, you know, then you get to the point of you have some moral responsibility for the predictable consequences of your actions. When you're stirring up huge complex systems like foreign nations, what is predictable is that you can't predict many of the consequences. And there's a moral element to that.
Well, you're suggesting two things to me. One of the happiest moments for civilization was at the end of a terrible war after World War II. The civil war in Nigeria between General Gowon and his Federalists and Ojukwu, the secessionists in the South, which they renamed Biafra. And it was a lot of killing, a lot of starvation. But when that war was over, the officers, the Nigerian officers, showed every bit of their British inculcation, of their British education. Prisoners were treated humanely. It was as though Britain had been the winning side and not the Nigerian Federalists. Americans were, newspaper men were staggered. The media could not believe that there was such a humane officers of the two sides, officers of the winning side, respecting the officers and men of the losing side. That was good. That was very, very good. I just wish that more of what Britain had to offer and more of what America had to offer would be lapped up by peoples who need it.
Barry, we're going into the last break. We'll go from here when we come back. The thing I love about talking to Barry Farber is he is so knowledgeable. He tells you so many new things that prompt 8 new questions that you want to ask him so that you can learn even more from his wonderfully and excitingly filled brain. Barry, it's always a pleasure. It's just always a pleasure to talk to you. We only have a couple of minutes left of this show. When I was on your show, we talked about the preference of some people like Rand Paul for constitutional war, going to war constitutionally, for constitutional intervention. And I indicated that there's a side benefit to doing it by the book, which is that it's easier, I think, usually to get national buy-in if you have Congress's buy-in on these kind of interventions. In the light of recent history, how do you feel, and as a prone freedom neocon, how do you feel about moving the dial back towards the Constitution, certainly the sentiment of the founders, in the way that we approach the world with a view to spreading our ideals?
I think it is absolutely wonderful. I've always wondered how England could stand it, not having a written constitution, but instead having a galaxy of oral understandings. Congratulations on building such a great nation without a written constitution. Obviously, our constitution is a piece of living political jewelry. I love it. I want to get back to it. But we have been in many wars since World War II. Not a one has been declared. We've got 1 minute left. Mm. I'm going to be the host now for this last minute.
Go for it. 45 seconds.
It may be my fault, but I don't know if Rand Paul has said anything since the beheading of American journalist James Foley. That's what I meant when I said everything has changed since you and I last talked, Robin. Mm. Do you know if Senator Paul has come out with a statement?
I don't know, and I haven't looked. I know he's in Guatemala healing people's sight right now.
Well, good for him. Do you know who else is an ophthalmologist on the world stage?
I don't.
We're
going into the break.
Bashar
Assad.
Yeah, he was educated in England. Ophthalmology.
Barry, that's the end of the show.
Okay, he's an eye doctor, but he doesn't have Rand Paul's vision.